You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, sales of electric bicycles are up. If you've got your eye on one, there are some things to think about first. We'll talk about what we ought to know before spending money on a new e-bike. Now, voting laws are front and center in Congress and in states around the country. Democrats in the House passed the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, but Republicans in the Senate are expected to block passage there. And Texas lawmakers passed a new bill aimed at tightening up voting laws in that state. Meanwhile, some high-ranking congressional Democrats are proposing something that might have been unthinkable for that party just a few years back, national voter ID requirements. Most Americans have valid voter ID, even the kinds of ID needed in states with stricter requirements, but millions of Americans don't have the kind of ID needed in such states. And that often means impoverished people, and people of color have trouble getting ID that they need to vote. Our next guest is proposing a solution, national ID cards, and he says it's got something for both parties to dislike. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Would you be in favor of nationally issued ID cards that could be used to verify identity when voting in any state? Do you think there should be a national voter ID law? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Russell Berman is a staff writer at The Atlantic, where he covers politics. Russell, welcome back to Central Time.
Great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Before we get to this idea of a national voter ID card, the conventional wisdom is Republicans want more voter ID, Democrats want less. But in your piece on voter ID, you say some Democrats in Congress are warming to the idea as some kind of compromise. What are we seeing there?
Well, the Democrats in Congress are sort of desperate to get a major voting rights bill through Congress with their slim majorities before next year's midterm elections. And we know the issue here is they have 50 votes in the Senate. They need Joe Manchin, the senator from West Virginia, to support them on this bill. They need him probably to support rolling back the filibuster in order to get it through. But anyway, Senator Manchin has circulated sort of his demands for a voting rights bill, and those include a voter ID requirement. Wouldn't necessarily be a photo ID, but it would be a voter ID requirement. And the interesting thing is that Democrats haven't shot it down. I mean, they have campaigned against strict voter ID laws that Republicans have passed in the states for years. But their response to Manchin is, we'll look at it, and it depends on the details, but we're not opposed to voter ID. And so that's going to be, right now, the Senate Democrats are basically trying to revise their voting rights bill, known as H.R. 1 or the For the People Act, to get Manchin's support. And when they unveil it in the next few weeks, we'll see if it includes that voter ID requirement that he's talking about.
One concern about voter ID laws when they're proposed or passed in states is, you know, what kind of IDs are involved? Are there people who don't have them and have difficulty getting them? What do we know about how tough it is for some portion of the population to have a valid voter ID card in the patchwork that we have from state to state?
Right. Well, in the studies that there haven't been that many studies, but in the studies that have been done over the years, anywhere between 6 and 11 or 12% of people do not have a government issued ID or don't have an ID that they would need to vote in the states that require it. That could be in inner cities where people don't drive. I'm in New York City, and a lot of people don't have cars, and so they don't have driver's licenses, for example. Or it could be poor people or older people who are past the age where they would drive. And so the driver's licenses, of course, are the most common forms of ID. And a certain percentage of the public does not have them. And that translates, according to some estimates, to 20, 21 million people. And that could be an underestimate. And so that's a lot of people who could be ineligible to vote, even though they would otherwise be eligible if they had an ID.
Now, here's your bold idea that, as I mentioned earlier, has something for everybody to dislike. It seems like a nationally issued voter ID card. Make the case for us.
Well, Republicans like to point out in their defense of voter ID requirements that you know, countries in Europe and all over the world require ID to vote. But most of these countries have a national ID. In fact, 170 out of the 200 countries in the world, 170 of them, give or take, have some form of national ID or are in the process of developing it. And that's an ID that, you know, you turn 16 or 17, depending on the country, and you register and you're given an ID. In some countries, you're automatically registered to vote. In other countries, it works, you know, more similarly to the United States. But the point is that they give everybody an ID. And so you don't have this access problem. And the access problem is the big problem that Democrats have focused on. They say now they would support voter ID if everybody could have easy, fair, cheap access to an ID. And so, you know, a national ID could solve that problem. The trouble is that, as one advocate told me, there's only three problems with a national ID. Republicans hate it, libertarians hate it, and Democrats hate it. In the United States, we're somewhat unique. I don't know if it goes to the, you know, American exceptionalism or what have you, but a national ID card in the national psyche has sort of conjured images of an all-knowing government, you know, authoritarianism. And so it's always been presumed to be unpopular by political leaders and elected members of Congress, even though when you ask people in polls, the question isn't that unpopular. So that's the suggestion.
Russell Berman is with a staff writer at The Atlantic talking about voter ID and the idea of a nationally issued voter ID card. Every eligible voter would get it. Maybe it would solve some of the debate over voter ID. You could join in at 800-642-123 with your thoughts, your questions on that idea. And Russell, in your reporting on this, I didn't know this has happened in my lifetime. You had a bipartisan commission led by a former Democratic president, a former Republican, I think Secretary of State, a commission looking at this idea of some kind of national ID. What happened?
Well, it's interesting because we're coming up on the 20th anniversary of 9/11. And in the aftermath of the 9/11 attacks, where you had the hijackers who were able to get, you know, forged, you know, passports, they were able to essentially get into the country. And the Congress, as part of the 9/11 Commission recommendations, moved toward what's known as Real ID. And that was a system that, and is a system, it's actually not fully implemented yet, they passed it, but it basically makes driver's licenses more secure so that they can be confident that, you know, their people are getting on planes are not terrorists. Now, they have always said that this is not a national ID, but there was this commission that you reference, President Carter and former Republican Secretary of State James Baker led it to consider election reform after the 2004 election. And this was right around the time when Real ID was being passed. And they assumed that a national ID was coming. And so they actually recommended that we use this Real ID that Congress had just created and make it a voter ID and to then require a voter ID. And so that was really the last time that there was any kind of Democratic buy-in for a voter, a federal voter ID requirement. And even then, though, it was controversial because you had President Carter who endorsed it and a few of the members of the commission endorsed it, but there was some dissent even in the commission. And then when the recommendation came out, a young senator by the name of Barack Obama appeared the next day with John Lewis, now the late civil rights icon, to say that this was a bad idea. And so Congress basically ignored it and from that point on, the question of voter ID became quite polarized, with Republican states passing strict photo ID laws and Democrats generally opposed to them.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Christopher is with us in Chippewa Falls. Christopher, hi.
Hi, how you doing? Thanks for having me.
Yeah, go ahead, Christopher.
So I think a voting ID, an ID just for voting is a pretty good idea, but I think it should be serialized, and I think it should be issued annually with a different serial number. You know, that way that way it makes it much more difficult for somebody with nefarious intentions to, you know, be able to manipulate somebody's ballot. Furthermore, I think it should be done at the state level. I think we have to be careful about doing such a thing at the federal level, because giving them even one step into nationalized elections, it can end up going a lot further than that. And that's my two cents on it.
Christopher, thanks a lot for the call. A lot there, Russell. Let's take that second point first. States often jealous of control of their own elections. Another reason why people might object to a nationally issued voter ID. What do you think, Russell?
I think that could be an issue. And I think that if this became a viable proposal, it might take the form similar to the Real ID, where it's just simply a requirement that the states issue an ID to every eligible voter. And it would cost, you know, it would cost money, but the amount of money it would cost is really nothing compared to the amount of spending that we're seeing, you know, proposed and passed over the last couple of years in Congress. And so this caller's idea might actually make it a little bit more difficult if you had to issue a new ID card every single year. That would probably be more costly for the states than something that was more like a driver's license that lasted for 5 or 6 or 10 years.
Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Russell Berman, staff writer at The Atlantic, where he covers politics. He's talking to us about voter ID laws and the idea of a national voter ID card. You can join in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Do you like this idea? A trade-off, in effect, yes, voter ID at the polls, but also, yes, a nationally issued voter ID card to all eligible voters. What do you think? What concerns would you have? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now with politics writer Russell Berman from The Atlantic. He's making the case for a national voter ID card, even if it's a tough sell for both parties. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts about that idea, your questions about how it might work, your own ideas. If you want to try to solve the voter ID debate in this state or this country, 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org, or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We heard there from Brandy on Facebook, who says it would be neat to have one ID that records all your info and licenses. So, Russell, would this be one card to rule them all, or would this be a specific voter-only ID card?
I think it would be closer to a one card to rule them all, because, you know, talking to advocates and the problem, some states actually do have voter ID cards, right, for people who don't want driver's licenses, but they just want to be able to vote. The problem is that it becomes much more difficult to get people to just want a voter ID card, because it only solves that one issue, right? You only need it once a year, you know, or twice a year. And so combining it with other uses like a driver's license or, you know, even a social security card is probably the better bet. Of course, that's going to raise that, you know, historically the problem, the opposition to national ID has been privacy. You don't want Americans don't want the government having all of that information. And what are they going to do with it? And is it going to be, you know, if they scan, you know, when they scan your card, how much are they getting to know about you? But of course, we give so much. I asked this question of Michael Chertoff, the former Homeland Security Secretary, and he says, we already have a national ID, except it's run by the big tech companies. Because, of course, we give so much information to places like Google or Apple or Facebook without even thinking about it. But we somehow still have a problem with giving it to the government.
Let's go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. James is with us in Washera. James, hi.
Hi, how you guys doing?
Good. What'd you want to bring up?
See, I've got three points I wanted to touch bases on. I live in a state of Wisconsin, and in this state, you can get a driver's license for driving, an issued state-issued driver's license. And if you don't drive, you can get a state-issued ID. Now, I don't understand why we need a national voter ID when it's so easy to obtain an ID, at least in the state of Wisconsin. And I wouldn't understand why every state doesn't issue a state ID if you do not drive. And as far as I'm pretty sure that even in the state of Wisconsin, that ID, just the state ID, is free of charge. And then my next point I wanted to bring up was the amount of homeless people that we have in all our states. Why shouldn't they be allowed to vote? They should be able to go and you know, get that state-issued ID of not having a home address in order to vote. But then those DMV sites could upload into a national site. Then there'd be no, you know, we don't need to create that national, you know.
I gotcha, James. Thanks a lot for calling in. So first of all, as he points out, you don't have to get a driver's license in Wisconsin. You can get a state-issued ID even if you're not driving. Is it fairly easy to do in every state in the union, Russell? You cited some studies that said it isn't necessarily that easy.
Right, and to be honest, I've told that it's maybe not as easy in Wisconsin as James makes it out to be, because you know, you have the issue of the cost, but you also have the issue, and he brings up homeless people. Well, to get an ID, you need to present documents like your birth certificate or your social security card. And what about people who don't have access to those? What if they've moved? What if they are not born in Wisconsin? So they have a birth certificate from another state, but they're now presenting their, you know, eligibility in Wisconsin. So the bureaucracy involved, and right now the burden is placed on the citizen to sort of prove who they are. And that can be a large burden for people who are at the margins of society, if they're poor, or especially if you're homeless. If you're homeless, you're less likely to have the ready access to the documents that you need. You don't have a bank account. You don't have much interaction with the types of institutions that sort of give you ID and give you sort of validate your identity for other institutions. And so that's where the devil in the details. And so a national ID, the idea would be that the government would have to have a base level of information about everyone. But they could use that information to then proactively issue ID cards and make it easier for everybody to get one, as opposed to the current system where it's really, you know, you go into the DMV, they're going to ask you for different kinds of documentation, and it could be a hassle and a big cost to satisfy.
Let's go back to our callers now. Thanks for that call. Mickey is with us next in Dodgeville. Mickey, hello.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about, Mickey?
Well, I moved here 7 years ago. And my husband was in the military, so of course I have a military ID as a dependent. But when I came to vote here in Wisconsin, my federal military ID was not accepted. I did not have a Wisconsin driver's license, so I had to go and get a Wisconsin military ID so I could vote here in Wisconsin.
Thanks for that call. I'm looking at guidelines. It says we're supposed to accept military ID cards issued by a U.S. uniformed service in Wisconsin. But that, Russell, thanks for calling, Mickey. That points toward this patchwork system in states where, you know, this state might take a student ID and this one not. Or this one might let you use your hunting license and this one not. And just a lot of different permutations around the country.
Thanks.
Oh, Russell? Do we still have Russell Berman? Not hearing him. We are talking to Russell Berman from The Atlantic, making the case for a national voter ID card, even if it's a tough sell for both parties. Taking your opinions on that at 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We've had people share their thoughts there as well. We can bring on more callers to share their thoughts on the idea, even in the absence of Russell. Let's bring on Philip in Greene County now. Philip, hi.
Hi, I'm an IT engineer for 45 years that deals with federal IDs and also with data and analysis. And there are several slippery slopes here. One is that you have states' rights versus federal mandates when it comes to voter laws. And the second thing is that there's absolutely no reason you can't have a linked database of state IDs and a federal oversight. So the federal oversight would issue what kind of IDs would it be acceptable, and then they would be administered by each state. So I don't understand why you would have to have some conglomerate super federal ID. It's just unreasonable.
Philip, thanks for calling in and sharing your thoughts on that. Philip, we're just about out of time. We heard from Cody on Facebook, who shares some of Philip's concerns. Cody writes, we already have state-issued IDs. Elections are state authority, not federal. Looks like we have Russell back just in our last minute. Russell, this point, states run elections, federal government shouldn't, therefore no voter ID. What do you think?
I think that's going to be a popular concern, but there's a way to do this by requiring, as I mentioned earlier, by requiring the states to issue their own IDs, and it would serve the same purpose of universal access to an ID that people can use to vote.
Russell, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Russell Berman, staff writer at The Atlantic. He joined us today to talk about voter ID laws and to make the case for the idea of some kind of national voter ID card that people could use to satisfy voter ID requirements. You can keep sharing your thoughts, by the way, over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up, are you thinking about getting an e-bike? You've got company. We'll find out what we should know before we go shopping for an electric bike. I'm Rob Barrett. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, after last week's anniversary of the Jacob Blake shooting, we check in with the Kenosha Racial Justice Group about what they've been working on and what work still needs to be done in the community. First, electric bicycles are getting more popular. Maybe you've seen folks in your neighborhood zooming around on one, going a little faster than normal. E-bikes have the elements of a traditional bicycle along with a rechargeable battery and motor, so it can do some of the hard work for you, like going uphill or into the wind. If you're interested in getting one, there are some things to think about first so you don't end up with buyer's remorse. Pam Moore is a freelance writer, speaker, marathoner, Ironman triathlete, and certified personal trainer in Boulder, Colorado. She's written about the growing popularity of e-bikes. We talked to her earlier this year. Here's that conversation. How much are people plopping down to pick up one of these e-bikes if people have thought about it, but they have no idea how much the bill would be?
It's a huge range. I did some research. It can really range from as like $500 on up to $15,000 was the most expensive bike I looked into. But that said, to get a decent one, experts I spoke to indicated that you should look to pay about $2,000 for a good quality bike that you're going to have with frequent use for 5 to 10 years.
All right, that's enough money to where you don't want to be real whimsical and random about your purchases. Can you talk about some of the factors to consider when buying an e-bike? One is, I guess there are three different classifications. What does that mean?
Yeah, that's a great question. So class one is an e-bike that can go 20 miles per hour. Class two will go 20 miles per hour. And it also has, in addition to having a motor, it has a throttle. So where you're just like pressing a button and like whoosh, there you go. And a class three bike can go 28 miles per hour. And which one you want really depends on what are you going to be doing with that bike. That is the biggest thing to look at, is what am I going to be using this for?
Yeah. So what might be best for, I don't know, I'm just going to tool around the neighborhood versus I'm going to take this out on a serious up and down course for hours and hours on end.
Yeah. Great question. So like if you're going around town with errands, like you're going to do groceries, maybe bring some kids around, you'd want a cargo bike. If you want to go on trails or gravel, a mountain bike. If you are, you know, like what you described, like a long winding ride, tons of hills, maybe you're commuting 30 miles each way, you might be better suited with a lightweight bike with more compact, like more aerodynamic geometry, like a road bike, so that you can maximize your battery life.
And one question you wrote about, go ahead.
Oh, well, there's also folding bikes, which are really cool. You can put those in your car. So say you and your partner want to go on a road trip and you want to explore the area by bike, throw your folding bikes in the car, and that's great for you.
One question you wrote about that I wouldn't have thought of, where am I going to store this thing? Why is that an important issue? How might it sway our decision making?
Yeah, that's huge. And I think people might not think of that, but the battery needs to be charged indoors. So maybe the question is like, are you bringing a heavy bike inside? Like, where do you live? Do you have a garage? If you have a garage or a backyard where you can keep it without it getting too wet, that's good. If not, if you're going to be bringing it up to a second or third floor apartment, how heavy is it? You know, your 60-pound cargo bike is not a great fit for storing it in your living room somewhere if you're in a condo.
And you also write, you're not necessarily just buying this e-bike. You're also buying a bike store. What should we look for in the place we buy it from?
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, for one thing, just for convenience, you want it to be close to where you live, because when you're bringing it in for service, that, you know, that just makes it convenient, number one. But number two, how do you feel when you go in there? Do you feel like they're just trying to sell you some bike that they can't move? Or are they really trying to find a bike that's for you? Because you're going to be going back there, not just for maintenance, but also for software updates. So you want to be comfortable with them and you want to feel like they're on your side.
I want to ask about that $15,000 bike, like, because I'm trying to figure out what a bike could do that would make somebody spend that kind of money on. Is that like a hover or something? What is it? What do I get for my $15,000?
It looks, I mean, the one that I'm thinking of in particular, it was a Specialized that I want to say it's made of carbon fiber. Don't quote me on that, but very lightweight. Looks like the kind of bike that you'd see the Tour de France riders riding on, a road bike. Very aerodynamic, very light. And high-end components like the drivetrain, the shifters, the brakes, all the moving parts are going to be as high quality as possible.
Now, some of my crabbier friends, Pam, have said, yeah, e-bikes, you're supposed to be out getting exercise on a bike. Why would you want it to do the work for you? I mean, you do Ironman triathlons. You're not somebody who avoids exercise. What is the appeal of an e-bike to you?
To me, it's just fun. Like when I think about taking my normal bike to the grocery store, I'm like, okay, then I got to attach the Burley. Then I got to like figure out exactly how my groceries are going to fit in there. And I'm going to be sweaty when I show up to the grocery store. I don't always want to show up sweaty. Maybe I just want it to be easy. Maybe I just want it to be fun. And I was surprised by how fun it was to test ride e-bikes. It was, you just got to try it. It's really fun.
We'll leave it there, Pam. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Have a great day.
That was Pam Moore, freelance writer, Ironman triathlete, and certified personal trainer in Boulder, Colorado. I talked to her back in March about the growing popularity of e-bikes. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Tyler Ditter with a story about losing a loved one during wartime.
For those who have fought and died in the U.S. Armed Forces, they leave with their families the weight of their sacrifice. Holly Higgins of Sun Prairie, Wisconsin, lost her son, Daniel Johnson, while he served in the Air Force in Afghanistan. Higgins talks about dealing with her loss with her other son, Eric Johnson, a specialist in the U.S. Army National Guard. They shared their experience as part of StoryCorps' Military Voices Initiative, which is made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
My name is Eric Johnson. I am 30 years old. I am in Sun Prairie, Wisconsin. I am here with my mother, Holly Higgins.
Holly Higgins. I'm 64 years old here in Sun Prairie, Wisconsin, with my son, Eric. What triggered you to want to go into the service to begin with?
One of my older brothers, out of four, Dan, was in the Air Force, and he had been for 2, maybe 3 years. He joined when I was still in high school, and I remember seeing a change in him in the way that he treated me as an older brother. I could tell that the military definitely impacted the way that he treated others, and I I kind of wanted that for myself in the transition of me making the decision to actually join. We found out that Dan was killed overseas. It wasn't an easy decision, but I think through his sacrifice, he still convinced me that what he stood for in regards to freedom and wanting to help others in the world, that it was worth it.
You know, it took me back. Hearing you talking about it makes me think back to when he first told me he was going to go into the Air Force and how I cried for many weeks. I was more afraid of him being hurt emotionally by war and combat. I didn't let myself even think that he could be physically or that he would die. And I remember him saying to me, you know, Mom, I'm going over there to save lives, not to take them. I don't even know how to put it, but I think knowing how important everything had become to you with what you were doing as an adult in your life, I was impressed with your courage, with your ability to choose to do what was right for you. And it was impressive. I'll always be afraid for you and your other brothers. You know, I mean, before Dan's death, I didn't think anything would ever happen to you guys. I just didn't think it could be possible. It wasn't going to happen to us, you know. Now I know that it can. And so there'll always be that. But I don't let that affect what I say to you or my trust and belief and hopes and pride in the choices that you make. I think you probably know about the mug he gave me and what that's come to represent for me with the poppies on it.
Yeah.
It's brought my spirit the ability to accept that this was Dan's destiny. That he found that mug in Scotland when he was 16 and brought it home for me. And at that point, no military discussion had ever been brought up. At the time, I didn't even notice that they were poppies. And he didn't know any, I don't think he knew what that would even mean. And it wasn't until 7 years after he was killed that I realized those were poppies on that mug. And knowing that poppies represent the death on the battlefield has brought me just a peace in my soul. I mean, I'll never not be brokenhearted and wounded over Dan's death. I'll never not miss him, and I'll never feel like it was okay that it happened. But I know in my spirit that somehow it was his destiny. It was his path.
That was Holly Higgins and Eric Johnson of Sun Prairie, Wisconsin. They shared their experience as part of StoryCorps' Military Voices Initiative, which is made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Tyler Ditter.
Coming up, the head of the Kenosha Coalition for Dismantling Racism joins the show to talk about last week's anniversary of the Jacob Blake shooting and local efforts on racial justice issues in Kenosha. That's next here on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Last week marked 1 year since the Jacob Blake shooting in Kenosha, and that's prompted some in the community to ask, what's changed since then? That includes our next guest, who leads an organization that's been working on racial justice issues in Kenosha for more than two decades. Adeline Green is head of the Kenosha Coalition for Dismantling Racism. Adeline, thanks for joining us today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
Sure. Well, your group has been asking the question of community members, what has changed in Kenosha in the last year? You share some of the videos of people answering that on your Facebook page. What's your answer to that question? What has changed in your eyes?
Well, in my opinion, there has been just a little change in Kenosha since the Jacob Blake shooting. I don't think there's been anything really significant that changed since that time. We believe that people have been made more aware of the issue of racism in this community. I believe some people did not believe that racism existed in our small community of Kenosha. But I think it was an eye-opener for them when that incident happened right here in our small community. It really shocked a lot of people because we thought we were really quiet, community. They got along, you know, with everybody, and that probably, you know, if there was racism, there was very little racism that existed. And so I think it was an eye-opener for folks, and it raised their awareness level in terms of racism and how it can present itself in any community, including Kenosha.
As I mentioned, your organization has been working on these issues for much longer than 1 year. What to you are still some of the biggest priorities that you want to see people talking about and changing in Kenosha?
I'd like for people to have conversations with people who are different than them, who have a different experience than them, and I want them to read and understand how racism impacts people of color on a regular basis. Oftentimes, the white community doesn't even know that racism exists and that it comes in many different forms. It happens individually, it happens institutionally, and it has to happen systemically. And our organization attempts to educate people and make them aware of the many faces of racism so that they can do something to address issues in our community before they become bigger issues.
How do you get people together and have those conversations? Because people from different walks of life with different attitudes, it can be hard to get them to sit down together, much less have a productive conversation.
And you're absolutely right. What we had done pre-pandemic is that we would have actual community conversations on a particular topic. For example, we talked about health disparities. We talked about educational disparities. We talked about police and community, minority community relationships. And what we do is we pick a topic and we invite the community to come to a forum, and we have a panel of people who lay out the issues, and then we let the community respond to some of the things that the panel members discuss. We had been doing that in person prior to the pandemic. Now we do it virtually. We have courageous conversations, that's what we call them, and we do them on Zoom, and we do them every other month, and we pick a topic, and we invite people to come, and whoever wishes to learn about racism is invited to participate either visually or they can chime in and give their opinion. So I think bringing people together, it helps people understand another person's perspective, and hopefully through that understanding, we can make some impact and make some changes that will bring more positivity to this community.
That's on the person-to-person level. As far as local leaders, governmental leaders in particular, what kind of response have you seen from them over the last year when it comes to racial justice issues?
I wish that we could say that we have gotten lots of response from them in terms of our conversations, I'll say. Now, on their own, the mayor of Kenosha, the county executive of Kenosha, have started some initiatives that they hope will address some of the issues that have come to light as a result of the Jacob Blake situation. I know the mayor has started a task force that deals with inequities in the community, and so has the county exec. He started a racial and ethnic equity commission and invited people from the community, and particularly people of color, to participate on this committee, on this commission, to start to pick apart some of the policies, some of the things that have held people of color back in this community with the hope of making it better in the future.
We are talking about Kenosha just over a year after the Jacob Blake shooting. Adeline Green is with us, leader of the Kenosha Coalition for Dismantling Racism. There's also a group, policing issues have been a big part of the conversation, a group called the Kenosha Coalition Organizing Resolution, working on alternative policing strategies. Can you talk a little bit about the work you're seeing there?
Yes. This is an organization that has just been formed recently over the last few months, because you're correct that policing is a big issue in this community as well as other communities when it comes to interactions with minorities and people of color. And this particular group called the Kenosha Coalition Organizing Resolution is a collection of diverse young people primarily who want to engage both the community and law enforcement so that issues do not arise where they come to the point like the Jacob Blake situation where there is an unfortunate interaction that happens. And so they engage the community and they call themselves violence interrupters. So if there's something happening in the community, maybe a fight between neighbors or friends, they try to engage those folks in a conversation, de-escalate the situation before the police are called and it becomes something more serious. So far, this has been working pretty well in the community. They've also started block parties in many communities where they invite the people who are living in the community to come together and just have a celebration. They will give free haircuts to kids that need it. They give food. They have music. And it's just a nice way of community getting to know each other, getting to understand each other, and minimizing conflict within neighborhoods. So it's a new organization, but if they continue on this path, I think they're going to make a really big impact in the Kenosha community.
I think sometimes it's easy in the media to only show up and talk about a thing after something horrible happens. Would you like to, like the Jacob Blake shooting, would you like to see more attention on that kind of positive community building effort that you were just talking about?
Absolutely. I think it's important to build relationships and create understanding amongst people. You know, you concentrate sometimes on the differences amongst people, but there are so many more commonalities that people have if they just come together and have a conversation. And so I, for one, am a proponent of communication, education, conversation that helps people get to know each other and to build relationships that will make the community more productive and help everybody in the long run. So, yes, the more positive things that can happen in this community, the better.
And how about, I should ask about relationships between community groups like yours and the local police department, a big concern in Kenosha and a lot of other places in the country. Do you see any bridges being built or productive conversations starting to happen?
I'm going to say I'm hopeful those conversations will happen. I believe that with the change in guard at the Kenosha Police Department, the previous police chief did retire, and there is a new person, an interim police chief, who seems to be more willing to participate and engage communities in conversation. And I think it has to start with the leadership. In order for things to change and the relationships between the community and the police to change, the leadership has to be willing to have these relationships, these positive relationships with community members. And so I see that as a positive. I hope it continues under the interim police chief, that these kinds of conversations and community events continue. And with the help of KCOR, I think this is going to continue in Kenosha.
In our last just half a minute or so, can you share one hope for your community in, say, 5 years or so, something that'll have improved?
I certainly hope that we will see more diversity in our leadership here in Kenosha, in the political forum, as well as in some of the businesses and in education. That's one of the things that has been pretty stagnant over the 30 years or so that I have lived here, that the leadership is primarily white. And I believe if you diversify the leadership, you're going to get some new and fresh ideas about how to engage community members and make this a better community for everybody.
Adeline, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Adeline Green, leader of the Kenosha Coalition for Dismantling Racism. She joined us today for a conversation about what the group has been working on for decades and since the Jacob Blake shooting just over a year ago, and what work she still thinks still needs to be done on racial justice issues in the community. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show. Tomorrow at 7:30, dollar store chains are already setting up shop in communities all over the country. They've done big business during the pandemic. Find out why tomorrow at 7:30 on The Morning Show. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then, Afghan refugees brought to the U.S. in recent weeks are beginning the process of resettling around the country. We'll talk about why that's got the Biden administration bracing for a debate over refugees in our weekly look at some of the top stories in national politics. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.